This is Only a Game. I'm Bill Littlefield. You can't go home again, or so the cliche goes. It means, I suppose, that once you've left a place, once you've grown up and moved on, you can't go back and finish what you started. Except sometimes you can. Only a Game's Karen Given has the story.
Have you been to campus?
Have
you
seen our campus? I have not, no.
Okay, put that on your list.
I'm not sure what I expected when I got on the line with the University of Wisconsin's new men's head hockey coach. I'm pretty sure I didn't think he was going to invite me to hop on an airplane and visit the school's campus in Madison.
It's a special place. You know, all the other places and stops that I've had, I was in San Jose, I was in LA, I was in New York, and then Colorado, Pittsburgh, Detroit. They were all great. They were great places to live, but this is home. It was in my heart, and I was wondering how I was going to get back there and be part of it.
Tony Granato left Wisconsin in 1987. A year later, he began his NHL career with the New York Rangers.
Tony Granato's speed and toughness have added a lot to the Rangers lineup, but perhaps the biggest surprise has been his offensive contribution. He leads the team with 13 goals.
After 13 years as an NHL player with New York, LA, and San Jose, Granato became an NHL coach. But as he packed his bags and moved and packed his bags and moved again, he carried with him a regret for something unfinished, something not done. That feeling would bring him back to where it all started, back in the mid-80s when he was a student athlete at Wisconsin.
I was an okay student. I was able to find ways to get good grades. Like I took classes that I enjoyed. But I enjoyed them while I was in the classroom. Once I left the classroom, it was all about hockey.
Granato was a two-time All-American. But playing for the Badgers wasn't the only thing distracting Granato from his studies.
I was fortunate enough to play on the U.S. national team my sophomore, junior, senior year. So every second semester those years, I would drop down classes because I would miss a month of school to go over and play in the World Championships. So I fell a little bit behind.
Granato had to take summer classes just to stay eligible. Come senior year, he was too far behind to graduate. He left Wisconsin about 20 credits shy of his degree. But he came back every summer during the NHL offseason to try to finish, at least for a while.
I wanted to graduate. I wanted to challenge myself to see if I could do it in the summer. So I did come back, got couple good classes under my belt and felt pretty good about my direction of pursuing a degree. And then the children came. So I put it off saying, hey, maybe someday, maybe someday.
Granato and his wife, Linda, had four children in 5 years. He says things got pretty busy. And after long hockey seasons that kept him away from his family, he just didn't have the heart to tell his kids that he'd be spending his summers in the classroom.
I thought about online classes. And then in the back of my mind, I thought, well, maybe when I'm done playing, I'd do it. And then obviously I jumped right into coaching. So that wasn't a great opportunity to do it either.
Granato spent 14 years as an NHL assistant and head coach. That's what took him to Colorado, Pittsburgh, and Detroit. But his heart was still in Wisconsin. He just never thought he'd have the chance to go back. Wisconsin requires head coaches to have college degrees. So when Barry Alvarez, Wisconsin's athletic director, called Granato last spring, it was only to ask for his opinion. Wisconsin was in the market for a new head hockey coach, and one of the top candidates was Granato's brother. Another was a coach he'd worked with for many years. Granato says he told Alvarez that he couldn't go wrong with either choice.
And then he asked me, well, you know, would you be interested? And I said, I won't do it. I won't interview against my brother and a good friend and someone who I think would be outstanding at the position. And he made this suggestion that why don't you, all three of you, come together?
That was okay with Granato's brother, Don, and friend, Mark Osiecki. But there was that other issue. Granato still hadn't gotten around to finishing that degree.
I brought that up right away. I said, hey, Barry, I'm short credits. I said, I think I'm short 10 to 15. And he goes, well, let me check on it, and I'll get it right back to you. And he went and checked the records and called right back and said that if you're able to commit to pursuing your degree and getting it within 1 year, we're good. We're doing the hire.
which would mean that 52-year-old Tony Granato would have to go back to school and sit in the same classrooms as his players, guys less than half his age. And why not? Granato's kids were grown, and he always said he'd finish that degree someday. So Granato said yes, which is not to say that he wasn't worried.
Well, a 52-year-old guy walking in with college students is somewhat intimidating. Was I going to be able to understand what the professor was saying? Was I going to be able to do okay in the classes? I don't just want to get through this class and get by. Now I want to challenge myself to be able to do well on it. So, you know, when I walked in there, you're nervous. It was first day back at school in 30-some years. So those were good nerves.
Granato's wife had bought him a backpack and some folders to keep him organized. But as it turns out, school supplies have changed over the past 30 years.
I get into class and, you know, I pull out my notebook and my paper and my pencil and I'm ready to take notes. And everybody else pops their computers out. Guy was rusty. I think I probably studied, you know, four times as much as I should have needed to. But it's gone well. I think I've learned a lot more about learning. The second time through, I think I'm absorbing more.
And that's not the only benefit to being a student coach.
Now I know what our student athletes are going through. I know the pressures of having to take tests. I know the pressures of having to be in class every day. I have not pulled all-nighters. Fortunately, hopefully I won't have to. I missed one class for a funeral. I missed one class for a recruiting trip. So other than that, my attendance has been perfect, and I think if you go to class and you're there and you take your notes, you're not going to fall behind.
I mean, that's really something you can say to your players, right? You can say from experience, this is all you got to do, guys.
I've mentioned that. They look at me kind of funny sometimes.
Granato's finishing his degree in human development and family studies. He chose that major back in the 80s because he was thinking about getting into teaching if that hockey thing didn't work out. Now he says his studies are helping him become a better coach. Some of Granato's players need the same classes that he's taking, but none of them have signed up to sit in a room alongside their coach, at least not yet. But when Granato talks to his players and their parents about the importance of getting an education, they know he's serious.
You know, when you start coaching college, you almost think like a parent. You got a lot more responsibility of helping them develop not only on the ice, but also as students and as young men. So I'd love them all to play in the NHL. They're not all going to go to the NHL and play in the NHL. If they don't have a chance to play professional hockey, I want them to be ready to have opportunities that they'll do well in and be ready for.
As for Tony Granato's own kids, they've all graduated from college, except his youngest, a daughter, who will just barely edge out her father for a college degree this May. Do you plan to walk at graduation?
Well, I do. Here's the problem. So my daughter is going to graduate from CU the day before. So I will certainly be at hers, and if we can conveniently make it back for mine, I will definitely do that. So this is another thing that I've done, and my kids have all laughed at me. So I had a son graduate from Arizona State. I had a son graduate from Tufts University. I had a son graduate from Santa Clara University. And at each of their graduations, I've put their gowns on and caps and taken pictures with me wearing them. So I will do that with my daughters. So I'll have my cap and gown from those four universities, and then the fifth one will be here from the University of Wisconsin.
And what do you think that will feel like after all this time, to have it be yours instead of theirs?
It'll be exciting. I'm sure it'll be somewhat emotional, too, because it's been a long journey. Being able to find time to get through it is something that I'll be proud of. It's going to be a great day, for sure.
All right, so last rather silly question.
Okay.
If Wisconsin
They haven't been silly yet.
Oh, good.
They've been pretty good.
Yeah.
I'm looking forward to this moment.
If Wisconsin has a great season this year, do you think you're going to start a trend of college coaches going back to school?
I would say most college coaches have already gotten their degrees, so I don't think that's going to happen.
It's too early to say whether Wisconsin will have a great season, though under Tony Granato, the coach, they're already much improved over last year. And Tony Granato, the student, says he's enjoying his back-to-school experience so much that he hopes to keep taking classes, even after he no longer has to. For Only a Game, I'm Karen Given.
Sometimes overcoming obstacles is a matter of patience. Waiting till the kids grow up to get a college degree is a good example, but sometimes obstacles seem insurmountable until you take a closer look. Here's commentator Alyssa Eli.
Naming no names, a person gets tired of humanity now and then. She wants silence and a reacquaintance with her own thoughts, if any are left. I found a remote mountain loop where there would be very little chance of running into anyone else with a Luna bar and a set of carbon hiking poles. I brought the dog. She was tired of humanity, too. 2 liters of water and the 10 essentials for hiking safety. The day was glorious, with wind and the sounds of nearby water. It was a pleasure to be so far from people. Misery and defeat a few hours in. There was nothing but up. A hard New Hampshire up with no switchbacks for relief. It dawned on me that we might not make it much farther. The dog had already reached this conclusion. She furrowed her brow and sat. What seemed like an unpassable rock mass appeared in the distance. When we came closer, we could see what it actually was, 4 small boulders. They'd been levered into a set of stairs, fit so tightly together you could see tool marks. Above them were more levered boulders, a second set, and a third flight of steps above that. In the middle of nowhere, someone had built the stairway to heaven. Some crew of strong, sweating, perhaps shirtless workers had carried shovels, levers, and hammer drills all these miles to nowhere and back again afterwards. They jimmied rocks into steps for the benefit of hikers they would never meet. We were anonymous to them. But that made no difference. They knew we'd be coming. Revived, the dog vaulted up. I followed, and from the top, breathing easier, looked down, way down. These stairs were miraculous. People, I thought, are truly marvelous.
Alyssa Eli is a psychiatrist living in Boston. We have lots more coming up on Only a Game, but first I'd like to thank App Cappy for her lovely review of our show. I've been listening to Only a Game since I was a young girl driving up to ski races with my dad. I still listen every week and love the show just as much. Thanks, App Cappy. Believe it or not, Only a Game is the number one rated program in the all-important young girl driving up to ski races with her dad demographic. Join App Cappy with a review of your own on iTunes or Stitcher. It helps other listeners to find our show. I'm Bill Littlefield, and it's time for 3 stories you should know.
Gentlemen, the hopes and dreams of an entire town are riding on your shoulders. You may never matter more than you do right now. It's time.
That's from the 2004 high school football movie Friday Night Lights, and we're going to start this week by talking about the future of that phenomenon. Joining me are Patrick Ruby of Vice Sports via Skype and Claire McNear from The Ringer. Welcome back to both of you.
Thanks so much for having me.
Always a pleasure to be here.
Patrick, why don't you take it away?
So at the risk of shameless self-promotion, which if you know me, you know it's not something I really consider a risk, I want to talk about a story that I wrote for Vice Sports. It's a long feature, and it's called Friday Night Lights Out, and it's the case for abolishing high school football. I followed a guy in Las Vegas. His name is Russell Davis. He campaigned for the Clark County School Board out there. It's about the 5th biggest school district in the country, explicitly on a platform of eliminating high school football. Now, as you might expect, this being America, it's not a very popular platform, and Russell Davis did not win his race. But I think the issues he raised are not going away. Should schools be in the business of football? And there's really kind of like 3 parts to the case of why they shouldn't. The first is medical. This is the one we're all paying attention to. The more we study how football affects the brain, the more we realize it's pretty bad. We've got former high school players, guys that never played a down in college or the NFL, being diagnosed with CTE. So that kind of leads to the ethical case against the sport, which is schools are supposed to be in the business of protecting and nurturing young brains. So what are they doing sponsoring a sport that seems to be putting those brains at significant risk? And why are taxpayers subsidizing that? And that's sort of the 3rd point. High school football is very expensive. And while sometimes these teams can make a little bit of money and help sponsor other sports, most of the time they lose money. The Dallas Morning News looked at this, and they found in Texas, that most of the schools were losing money on high school football, which is kind of amazing. So the question really is, you know, what are we getting on our investment here? And the answer might be not a lot and not something that's worth it.
Yeah, I mean, for me, the one of the scariest things about the sort of debate we've been having about safety in football is you hear all these players saying that they didn't know what the risks were. After Concussion came out, I think it was last year with Will Smith in it, it was a big hit. And you had all these NFL players coming out and just saying they had no idea. And they were shocked and they were horrified and they were angry, and rightfully so. So I guess I wonder if there's a way to incorporate education of the risks into football. And I mean, I don't know if you think that's possible at that level, but
that's a really good question. It's also one of the things that make this so thorny at the high school level, because the idea of informed consent, and again, we're talking about minors here, so it's really the really kids' parents, not just the kids themselves. What are the risks? And the truth is, like, they're kind of fuzzy right now. It's hard for us to sort of quantify and define them because we haven't been studying this problem for that long. So it's actually really hard to come up with sort of an informed consent form. And secondly, again, because we're talking about minors, there's sort of the question there of, like, is this even appropriate?
Well, I have to take a stand on this issue. I like happy crowds. I like people coming together to have fun at what is usually a big party. I'm in favor of youngsters getting credit for doing things well. And if the credit comes in the form of cheering crowds, so much the better. It's great. However, brain damage I'm not in favor of. So when the bright lights go on of a Friday night or of a Saturday afternoon or of a Thanksgiving Day evening or whatever it is, can the game at the center of the celebration be flag football? Would anybody go?
That's a great question as well. All these things that are true and good benefits of high school football, you could get all of those without the tackling. And that kind of speaks to what is it that we all really like about this sport? Is it all their stuff, or is it actually the violence?
I love the crickets chirping as that question sits, waiting for somebody to punt it somewhere.
You can't see me, but I'm flinching.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, I think that's the dirty secret, at the dirty not-so-secret at the center of football. The reason it's the most popular sport in America is because it's the sport we can watch and see people get their knees torn up and their heads beaten up. And as long as that's not happening to the people in the stands, they enjoy it thoroughly.
One last really quick point. You know, people say we love football too much, this can never change. And honestly, that's a pretty compelling argument. On the other hand, I would say if you went to your local high school and said, hey, guys, let's start a high school boxing team, people will look at you like you're crazy. Mm. So things can definitely change.
Claire, it is December, and I understand you have a baseball story for us anyway, right?
I sure do. So next week, baseball's winter meetings will take place just outside of Washington, D.C. And one of the changes that's already been announced is that the Oakland A's will be phased out of revenue sharing, which had been providing the team with about $35 million a year. This has been taken as a sign that the A's owners are finally willing to invest in a new stadium, probably in Oakland. But the owners are notoriously thrifty. They have one of the lowest payrolls in baseball. I think it's 26th of the 30 teams. And a habit of trading fan favorites just when they get good and expensive. As a result, attendance in Oakland is some of the lowest in the league. So my question is, you know, should they just sell instead?
I mean, look, this is my answer for across all pro sports. It's like, since there's a limited number of teams, since these leagues sort of have quasi-monopolies, or it's like in baseball's case, they actually have an antitrust exemption. And since there, you know, there's plenty of concentrated wealth in our country, and I think in the Bay Area, there's a lot of rich people. That's what I've heard. I'm not sure. So my thing would be, yes, they should sell. If you can't afford to be in this game, and by the way, a rigged game where, like, basically it's really hard to not make money, then absolutely you should sell to someone richer who was willing to maybe lose money once in a while in order to have a competitive team. Hmm. I don't think there's really that much question about it. But my question for Claire is, I'm pretty intrigued, is when you say the owners are maybe willing to put money into a new stadium, does that mean that they're expecting the public to put even more money into a stadium, or how's that going to work?
That never happens.
Yeah, you know, that it's unclear. They've sort of been dancing around this idea for the last decade. The mayor of Oakland has kind of taken a hard stand against using public money for stadiums, at least as far as the Raiders are concerned, which is sort of why the Raiders have been having this public flirtation with Vegas and some other places. But, you know, the strange thing about the A's is that when the owners, the current owners, bought the team in 2005, they were one of the richest ownerships in baseball. And they've just not really invested in the team. And they like to blame the attendance problems on the Coliseum, which, to be fair, is a dump. It is.
They have raw sewage problems, right?
There's raw sewage, and it's just concrete everything. And it's the last NFL and MLB dual-use stadium in existence. But, you know, it seems like the problems might go beyond just that.
This is an old story that won't go away, although with the revenue-sharing change, it does have a new twist. However, I have the solution to this if the owners are listening at this point. If I were king of the forest, I would arrange to have Theo Epstein put in charge of the front office in Oakland, and then it wouldn't matter who owned the team because they would win the World Series and everybody would be happy and attendance would go way up. So that would solve the problem, right?
I have a more plausible solution, which is like tell Donald Trump, President-elect Trump, that the A's are going to move to Japan. And then we'll get all sorts of government subsidy and they can stay or stick around and pay their players a decent wage.
All right. For my topic, I would like to turn to the opposite end of the sports quality spectrum. LeBron James was named Sports Person of the Year by Sports Illustrated. And the rationale is obvious. Besides being a very good basketball player, he's the guy most responsible for bringing Cleveland a championship. And that's something that hadn't happened there since the Browns finished atop the NFL back in 1964. Many people now living were alive when that happened. Almost nobody now living was alive when the Chicago Cubs last won baseball's North American Championship, called by some the World Series. How could SI not have named the entire Cubs organization Sports Person of the Year? And if they had to give it to just one person, fine, give it to Ernie Banks. He's dead, but so what? They gave it to a horse one year. It's a silly award anyway, but it certainly should have gone to the Chicago Cubs this time around. Missed opportunity. Do better next time, SI.
Yeah, I'm going to have to disagree here. You know, you mentioned LeBron James. You know, he not only was responsible for delivering Cleveland that championship, he was also responsible for delivering the Golden State Warriors blowing a 3-1 lead in the NBA Finals. So on behalf of the entire internet, I have to go with LeBron. He's a much better meme.
Claire, are you okay with that? You're going to break the tie.
Oh, well, you know, I think, Bill, that's spoken a little bit like somebody who thinks this Cubs win was a one-time deal. But I think Sports Illustrated...
No, it happens about every 110 years. It's no problem.
But I think Sports Illustrated might have a little bit of a bias towards towards things that would look good on covers. Mm. And I think LeBron James crying on the floor looks a little bit better. There's no kind of single iconic image, I think. There are a lot of, you know, great images of the Cubs' victory, but there's not just the one. You know, there's no J.R. Smith with his shirt off in the parade, so... Mm.
Yeah, Sports Illustrated also produces a swimsuit issue, so I cannot believe you'd accuse them of being biased towards things that look good on covers.
I'm going to let you guys in on my hot take, which is that I think the Cubs are the new Red Sox in that they will win again because they're a great team and they're a lot of fun and they're young, but they will soon draw the ire of fans across the country. Mm. And SI gave the award to the Red Sox in 2004, and, you know, honestly, I think they're afraid of the backlash this time.
Claire, I kind of hope you're right. It would take the heat off the Red Sox. That'd be all right. My guests for this week's three stories you should know have been Patrick Ruby of Vice Sports and Claire McNear from The Ringer. Thanks to both of you.
Thanks so much.
Thanks as always.
There's a simple storyline in the tale of the short, surprising college football career of Joe Thomas Sr. It has to do with the fulfillment of a dream Thomas had sustained for 36 years. But that simple storyline is complicated by that most malleable of human characteristics, memory. We'll start with the simple part. The peak experience in Joe's story occurred on Saturday, November 19th, playing for South Carolina State in a game they'd win 32-0. Joe took a handoff, and...
Joe Thomas Sr. just picked up 3 yards on the carry. So what a run for Joe Thomas Sr., who has been wanting to play college football his entire life. just carried it for 3 yards for South Carolina State.
Joe Thomas had waited 4 years to carry the ball for SC State, but when he commented on his achievement, Joe kept it simple.
Well, I was a little nervous. Butterflies. But after the first carry, I felt good. I was happy, very happy.
Perhaps the story should have ended after that first carry. Three more handoffs that day brought Thomas's stat line to -1 yard rushing, which must have felt anticlimactic at best, and sort of isn't rushing at all. But no matter. At the age of 55, Joe Thomas had become the oldest player ever to compete in a Division I football game.
I don't give up very easy. Something I always wanted to do. A dream come true. Even though I'm 55, I feel 25.
Joe's teammates were proud of what he'd accomplished. After the game, they lifted him up to their shoulders and bore him from the field. Joe tried not to get any more carried away than was necessary.
I'm kind of a calm guy. I don't get excited, jumping in the air like a lot of ball players does. I just play the game. Something I always love and something I always want to do.
In pursuing that dream, Thomas was exceptionally persistent. He'd always wanted to attend nearby South Carolina State, which had recruited his football-playing son. He enrolled in 2012 after his various business interests had tanked. Joe thought maybe a college degree would change his luck, and he thought he'd give college football a try. The thoughts didn't necessarily come in that order, but the athletic director felt as if Joe Sr. in uniform might be good press for the college and went along with the dream. Anyway, Joe Thomas walked on to the same team for which his son Joe Jr. was playing. The younger Thomas would eventually make it to the NFL. He plays for the Green Bay Packers. Joe Sr. played on at the college level, or practiced at least. Joe's initial efforts did not impress SC State head coach Buddy Pough. His evaluation of himself is different than our evaluation of him, Coach Pough told Sports Illustrated's David Gardner. And Pough wasn't the first coach to come to that conclusion.
In 1980, I was principal of the Blackville Elementary School and football coach and athletic director at Blackville Hilda High School. And I guess I'd have been 34 years of age in 1980.
Which means that now Tim Moore is 70. He's practicing law these days in Barnwell, South Carolina, and he sees Joe Thomas around town from time to time. Used to work out in the gym Thomas used to run, in fact. Moore was, of course, aware of his former player's adventure on the football field 2 weeks ago.
I was hoping he wasn't going to get hurt. Older bodies just don't take those legs. Those kids out there now are really big, really fast, and really strong.
With the clarity common to lots of coaches, Tim Moore recalls the men who played for him when they were boys, Joe Thomas among them.
He was quiet, didn't say a lot. He was determined. He wasn't very big. He weighed 165 or so pounds, and we actually played him that year at defensive guard and running back on offense.
Running back on offense. Joe Thomas remembers that, too. And practically ever since he graduated from high school 36 years ago, he's been telling anyone who would listen that if Coach Moore had let him carry the ball more often in the state semifinal game in 1980, Blackville would have prevailed. That story might have held up if Joe Thomas hadn't become a celebrity in November, when speculation began that he might actually play. But when you're about to become the oldest D1 football player ever, people pay attention for a while, and they do things like look up your old high school coach, which, at the instigation of Sports Illustrated, eventually led to a sort of reunion in Tim Moore's law office.
Well, we spent a couple of hours talking, and Joe had a couple of different memories about things, how they occurred, and he said, well, if I'd let him run the ball more, we would have won the game. And Joe didn't remember that he had fumbled the ball right at the end of the game and gave the other team the ball deep in our territory, and they scored a touchdown and beat us 13-8.
According to Joe's memory of that semifinal game in 1980, he was never given the opportunity to carry the ball after the first quarter. Unhappily for Joe Thomas, Tim Moore is a self-acknowledged pack rat. He saves everything, including the records of each game he coached, and he knows what happened. But Moore understands how it is with some athletes. The older they get, the better they were.
You know, I've recently had all of my games that I coached transferred over from film to DVDs so you can look at them on the computer. And And I actually ended up with a couple of my high school games when I was playing in high school back in the early 60s. And another old coach told me, when he said, you know, that film just ran slower back in those days.
Memory's sometimes good to us that way, whether or not we're athletes. When I spoke with Joe Thomas, he said he'd always wanted to play college football, and he assumed it would happen when he got out of high school 36 years ago. According to Tim Moore, coaches back in 1980 didn't see Thomas as a prospect. They were looking for bigger, faster running backs whose grades wouldn't be an issue. But at the age of 55, Joe Thomas Sr. got the last laugh, didn't he? He walked on at South Carolina State, and he hung in there through injuries and three seasons on the bench. And when he got the ball, he didn't score, but he didn't fumble. And if 20 years from now he's telling people he ran 94 yards as the clock ran out to win the game, well, who's going to say it ain't so? We'll be right back with Charlie Pierce and more sports NPR style. Ahead on Only a Game, a tale of two veterans who met on the Rose Bowl gridiron on the battlefield in Italy and then again after the war.
Charles Haynes embraced Frank Parker, gave him a hug, told everyone at the reunion, kept pointing out that this was the man who saved his life.
And you can follow us on Facebook and Twitter at Only a Game NPR. I'm Bill Littlefield. Coming up next week on Only a Game, a story of corporate fraud and artificial turf. But first, I'm joined by Charlie Pierce for our look at the week's news. Hello, Charlie.
Hey, Bill.
Earlier in the program, I had my say on Sports Illustrated's choice for Sportsperson of the Year. It's your turn now. You okay with LeBron James?
Sure, absolutely. He's going to get it sooner or later anyway, and he's never going to have a better year than he had at the end of last year, so sure. Yeah. I got no problem with it. Okay. What's your problem with it, Bill?
Cubs! Cubs win!
You know, you will hear that because, as you recall, they gave it to the Red Sox.
I know.
That one year.
And they gave it to a horse another year, so come on. Charlie, management and labor reached an agreement this week, so peace will prevail among Major League ballplayers and their employers. The two sides also decided that the result of the All-Star game will no longer determine who has home field advantage in the World Series, and hooray for that, says I. What about you?
I don't know. I think that could have been made to work. I don't know why everybody complained about it so much. Now the All-Star game goes back to being meaningless. I mean, totally meaningless. Utterly without meaning.
What, you get to see stars play baseball.
Yes, you do. And now we have interleague play, so you get to see that a lot.
There will be four new LPGA tournaments next year and an increase in prize money as well. One of those tournaments is going to be in Scotland. This is a reverse of a recent trend, isn't it?
You mean more events and not less?
Yes, exactly.
That's right. I think it's all to the good. You know, the LPGA is a remarkably long-standing and successful enterprise.
Duke basketball fans are notorious for the, shall we say, enthusiasm they display at games. Sometimes they're funny, sometimes they're not. On Tuesday night, when Duke played Michigan State, a fan held up a sign that said, "The water tastes better in North Carolina." Free speech and everything, but given what's gone on in Flint, very bad idea, I'd
No,
say.
I mean, this is the Duke students demonstrating their notorious ability to be jerks, basically. And by the way, the water ain't so good in North Carolina right now either, but I'm glad both schools stood up, you know, immediately thereafter and said there's no place for this kind of nonsense. And I'll tell you, they're just lucky that Mateen Cleaves doesn't play for Michigan State anymore.
For the first time this season, I perused the Associated Press women's basketball poll, Charlie, and I thought there must have been some mistake. UConn wasn't in the top spot.
Yeah, is there any reason why that happened, by the way?
Error. Mistake.
I mean, it's got to be a typo, right? They haven't lost a game in 15 years or something. Did somebody come within 25 of them this week
and must have been it.
And cast some doubt, or is it just the you know the traditional Notre Dame ballot stuffing?
Well, either that or Gino Auriemma had a cold. I don't know, something.
But you know that he's exactly what he wanted.
Oh, sure. Now they're the underdog.
Now nobody respects the team that's won 900 games in a row. Nobody thought we could do it, said Gino, and everybody laughed.
It's week 13 in the NFL, and that means it's also my cause, my cleats week. Players are allowed by the league to wear shoes that draw attention to a cause or to an organization, and the shoe urging the prevention of cruelty to animals is very cute, I think.
Yeah, that's also known as you have our permission to have fun now.
Yeah, once.
Week. in the NFL. Yeah, Ezekiel Elliott, the rookie running back from Dallas, has painted a nice little puppy on his shoes.
We learned from Jimmy Dugan, the character Tom Hanks played in League of Their Own, that there is no crying in baseball. I had always assumed that there was also no kissing in football, but this week I learned I was wrong, at least as regards football as played in Houston, right?
You know, apparently there is no kissing in football unless you tie the game and have brought your sister to the game, apparently. But, yeah, Tom Herman, the coach at the University of Houston, who's very sought after for larger jobs at this point, kisses his players on the cheek when they come in to show his love for them. And I think that's absolutely adorable, and I think there are at least 60% of the other football coaches in America who are now going, ooh.
On Sunday night, Gerard Gallant lost his job. He had been the head coach of the Florida Panthers hockey team. The team lost the game in Raleigh against the Hurricanes, after which Mr. Gallant's bags were taken off the team bus, and he was told to get a cab and find his own way home. They might have at least given him a ride to the airport, don't you think?
That's an unbelievable visual. If you haven't seen the pictures, go online and see them. The guy with his little rollerboard, you know, waiting hailing a cab to get home. I mean, this is really something. If he'd had a sword, they would have broken it over his knee, you know, ripped his epaulets off.
High school goaltender in the news this week in Minnesota. He recently had quite a game. He had 98 saves. A lot of goaltenders. That'd be a career. Anyway, it might be a state record, but this particular goalie can't be entirely happy with his performance, I guess.
Yeah, because he made 98 saves, and his team lost 12-0. And this is what generally gets your defenseman smothered in their sleep. It's an extraordinary thing. Can we please get this kid for one season, let him transfer to a team that can really play?
And finally, Charlie, the FFA Cup final in Melbourne, Australia, was interrupted due to injury. Sydney FC goalkeeper Danny Vukovic insisted that the game be delayed until an injured onlooker could be whisked to the sideline, where the onlooker could recover without being in danger of suffering a second concussion. What the heck happened?
Somebody hit a seagull with the ball.
And the goalie stopped the game.
I thought that was really nice. The seagull is now in the Australian rules football concussion protocol and probably will be available for the playoffs. I just had the vision of this doctor with his finger in front of the seagull's eyes going, can you follow my finger? And the seagull saying, just give me a clam, damn it.
Doc, you can find the sports writing of Charlie Pierce in Sports Illustrated. And, of course, he joins me each week on Only a Game as well. Thanks, Charlie.
Thanks, Bill.
The first thing Charles Haynes and Frank Parker had in common was that they played in the same football game. For a couple of reasons, it was an unusual game. It was canceled, argued about, then uncanceled, and then relocated. The game customarily took place on New Year's Day in Pasadena, California, but not in January of 1942. That was because on December 7th, 1941, the Japanese had bombed Pearl Harbor. Pasadena was close enough to Hawaii to arouse concern.
And about 6 days after Pearl Harbor, Lieutenant General John DeWitt, who was in charge of the 4th Army on the West Coast based on the Presidio in San Francisco, made the determination that the Rose Bowl game should not be played, that if that many people were in the same spot, the Japanese bombers were likely to target it and the Rose Parade. So he asked the governor of California to call off the game, which he did.
That's Brian Curtis, who has studied and written about the events of that time. Among them, the debate over the fate of the 1942 Rose Bowl game.
Many in America were split, and the newspapers nationally weighed in. There were editorials stating that we are now a country of war. Our young boys are going off to fight. The last thing we should be thinking of is playing some silly football game. Then there were other newspapers and Americans that weighed in and said, wait a minute, if we stop playing our games, if we stop living our lives, then the Japanese have beat us, even though they only attacked us in Pearl Harbor and Hawaii.
The latter point of view won out. The 1942 Rose Bowl game was played, but it was relocated to Durham, North Carolina, home of Duke University. Oregon State would play Duke because, as the winners of the Pacific Coast Conference, Oregon State had earned the right to pick their opponent. They chose Duke, the team generally regarded to be the nation's strongest that season. Oregon State graciously agreed to travel across the country for the game. Duke's roster included Charles Haynes, a local boy from Durham.
Charles was a good student, a great wrestler, an okay football player, a Boy Scout, an Eagle Scout, whose father worked for the American Tobacco Company in Durham, as tobacco at that point was still the center of life in Durham and much of North Carolina. He matriculated to Duke and played on the football team for Coach Wallace Wade, often found himself more as a cheerleader from the sidelines as opposed to playing.
Among those determined to upset Haynes and his highly regarded teammates was Frank Parker, an imposing Oregon State guard.
Frank Parker couldn't have been farther away, literally and figuratively, from Charles Haynes. Parker was a very poor boy whose father died running bootleg liquor on Christmas Day when he was just 12 years old. At the age of 13 or 14, was helping to pick up trash and drive dump trucks with his stepfather, who actually was his uncle, but that's another long story, and was smart enough and good enough and strong enough to go to Oregon State University and start studying agriculture.
Charles Haynes, the son of a wealthy tobacco merchant, may or may not have had any contact with Frank Parker, son of a dead bootlegger, before, during, or after that transplanted football game in which Oregon State upset Duke before an estimated 50,000 spectators. Shortly thereafter, Haynes and Parker had something else in common. They were both in the Army. Haynes was turned down the first time he tried to enlist. He had to memorize the eye chart to pass the physical. Parker also enlisted, and during what must have seemed an interminable delay, he was shipped from base to base within the U.S. By the early summer of 1944, Haynes was in Italy, fighting for territory, hill by hill, yard by yard. And that's where he crossed paths once again with his former Rose Bowl opponent.
In July of 1944, Frank Parker finally came over to Italy as a replacement soldier. And within a day or two of his arrival, they met. Frank was very shy and quiet, contrary to his large behemoth size. Charles Haynes was always willing to strike up a conversation, and he did with Parker. And very quickly, they realized their connection, that they had both played in this remarkably transplanted Rose Bowl game, you know, at that point, 2.5 years earlier. So they became friendly. They were stationed, obviously, in the same division, almost in the same platoon. So they often were fighting side by side in action.
On a day when the two former rivals were not side by side, Charles Haynes led his company up a hill he'd thought was quiet. He was surprised by a German artillery attack.
So he was wounded, had wounds in his chest the size of a fist, wounds in his leg. It started to rain. It was too dangerous for his fellow soldiers to rescue him. So for 17 hours, Haynes thought he was dying, coming in and out of consciousness. Word had gotten back to Frank Parker, who was in another part of the fight, that Haynes had been wounded. And it was Parker and another soldier that made their way up to the top of this ridge. Haynes was conscious at the time. He recognized Parker. Parker and this other soldier were able to carry Haynes under fire down a hill to a medical aid station.
Parker returned to battle immediately after the rescue. Haynes spent several months in hospital and then returned to his unit. When the war ended, Haynes took up the life of a wealthy young man in Durham once again. He ran a construction business, he opened up a restaurant, he was apparently able to leave behind the horrors of battle. The man who saved his life was not so fortunate.
Frank Parker suffered like many veterans did. In fact, he stayed over in Europe an extra year or so when he didn't have to, because he was so worried that he had changed fundamentally as a person, as a human, as a Christian, that he was not the same person that his wife, Peggy, had married.
Haynes, gregarious after the war as well as before it, thrived in business and in his personal life. He told people about Frank Parker and the exceptional coincidence that had found his former opponent on the football field saving his life on a muddy hill in Italy. Parker eventually returned to Oregon. He rarely told his family anything about what he'd seen and done during the war, and he found adjustment to civilian life as hard as he'd feared it might be.
I think even his children understood at an early age that Dad had issues, and at times would disappear into a bar for a day or two. Never heard his kids, never heard his family, you know, got into fishing and would disappear for months on end.
Parker apparently felt that absence would spare his family embarrassment and shame.
And it really wasn't until he was about to attempt suicide after his wife's passing well into his 70s that he finally went to a VA and was hospitalized for a couple months.
During the years after the war, Haynes and Parker wrote each other a few times. Duke hosted a reunion for both teams from the 42 Rose Bowl, but Frank Parker didn't make the trip from Oregon. So Haynes, restaurateur and businessman, and Parker, disappointed fisherman, didn't see each other until October 1991, when Oregon State hosted a 50th reunion gathering for the veterans of the only Rose Bowl game ever to have transpired outside of Pasadena. Haynes was determined to get to that second grand occasion.
Charles Haynes made the effort to cross the country solely to be able to see Frank Parker and thank him. Charles Haynes embraced Frank Parker, gave him a hug, told everyone at the reunion, kept pointing out that this was the man who saved his life. As they read the names of deceased players for Oregon State and Duke, Haynes started to cry and looked across the room at Parker.
Parker presented Haynes with a money clip carved from a whale's tooth, a souvenir of the months Parker had spent at sea as a fisherman. Haynes was the beneficiary of Parker's exceptional courage, and Parker was a hero. Hero is a word too often applied to football players and other athletes who save nobody. But though Frank Parker saved Charles Haynes, he couldn't rescue himself from the consequences of the terrible personal damage he suffered during the war. The unraveling of Parker's life after the war is something Brian Curtis feels shouldn't be forgotten.
We think of this generation as the greatest generation for their heroism, which is absolutely true. What we don't hear a lot about is the homelessness, the divorce, the alcohol, the lack of mental health care that many of these gentlemen got. So Frank Parker suffered like many veterans did, never fully came to grips of the man he became.
Charles Haynes had a heart attack and died in 1994, just 3 years after that reunion in Oregon. Frank Parker was eventually diagnosed with PTSD and depression, and he died in a nursing home in 2002. In his new book, Fields of Battle, Pearl Harbor, the Rose Bowl, and the Boys Who Went to War, Brian Curtis explores at greater length the lives of Charles Haynes, Frank Parker, and some of the other young men who went directly from the football field to the war in Europe. Only a Game is produced by Karen Given and Martin Kessler. We had help this week from Alex Schroeder. Our technical director is Marquise Neal. Our intern is Jeremy Relosa. We had help this week from WSSB in Orangeburg, South Carolina. Our senior producer is Gary Wallach. Our final word comes from Tim Moore, high school coach of Joe Thomas, the man who would set the all-time record for oldest college football player at the age of 55.
I'm not encouraging a bunch of 56-year-olds to go out and play football.
Well, why not? Bunch of 56-year-olds running around. How fast could they be? Maybe nobody gets hurt, and then they all go to the restaurant for the early bird special. I'm Bill Littlefield. We return next week with more sports, NPR style, and Only a Game. And thanks for listening.